Dorothee Zola is a theologian. She's German, but she's presently at Union Theological Seminary, New York. Has done a great deal of work with primarily liberation theology. And what I would like to do with this is, there are like 3 days. And initially to just start where she starts and to share the process that she goes through to, has she's gone through to come up with a theology of creation. And the reasons why she was prompted to do that, to give a little bit of her theology in relationship to creation and to liberation, and then to explore how she puts it into the concept of to work and to love. And hopefully, it'll all make sense. Also, just to share that I came in September, and I was here for probably a month before all of the programming like this ended, and we moved into a different style of life at Holden, which was the winter program, which where people came to study for 10 weeks. And so the preparation for that and my involvement in that is different than teaching in the summer program. So this is like a brand new experience for me this morning. And you are all the first.
Guinea pigs, come on.
Right, that's right. I did a couple of forms last fall, but they were quickly put together. One was my most embarrassing moment. And the other one was, what is it, you know, everything you always wanted to know about women pastors but were afraid to ask. I shared that with another woman who was on teaching staff. But this one, I picked up this book when I was out a couple of months ago, and I got very excited about it. It's published by Fortress Press in Philadelphia. And the reason I became excited by it is because she is helping me to have a growing or changing sense of what it means to be a participant in the creation and in the sharing of the earth. So, just to share a quote from her first paragraph. She said that I have come to realize that our capacity to praise creation hinges. Let me try this again. I have come to realize that our capacity to praise creation hinges on our capacity to involve ourselves in creation. She said, for a person to praise something in nature, for instance, a magnolia tree amid the gray monotony of a city street, she has to be involved in that which she extols. Her active praise means that she has acquired an intimate knowledge of this particular magnolia. She can visualize it in movement or at rest, in varying hues at different times of the day and night, and these are imprinted on her memory. With her growing sense of this magnolia's beauty comes her own growth. She too, the stargazer, participates in nature's beauty through naming, recalling, knowing those distant entities, and his praise is nourished through his contemplation of the galaxy. The aesthetic process is the result of our participation in the created order. She says she was prompted to write this book for two reasons. One was fear. The fear of those who plan a limited nuclear war and who pave the way for a nuclear holocaust. And when she says this, she is talking about either a witting or an unwitting conspiracy to undo creation. She says there are two poles. There's creation and there's exterminism. And exterminism is, there are three elements of that, or evidences of exterminism. One is the rape of the earth. The second is the war against the poor, which is an interesting way of putting it. And the third is the nuclear threat of the arms race. When we stockpile arms, she says, we make the rich richer and we exhaust the earth's unrenewable resources. But she said it wasn't just fear or survival instinct, but just an unswerving love for creation. And she sees that her love for creation, her sense of being a participant in creation, that prompts her to want to share that understanding with the hope that others may also come to share that understanding. She said it means, having this love for creation means knowing what kind of life we want to have. What kind of life is it that we're trying to conserve? And that sacredness of the earth is that we are stewards of the earth, not creators of the earth, and that it is not disposable. There are resources that cannot be renewed. And so as human beings, we need to look at our participation, our care, our stewardship of the earth. And the second reason, the other factor that prompted her to write the book, was a whole transformation in her own personal theological outlook. So I said she was German, and as a German woman, as a German theologian growing up in just prior to and during World War II, there was a sense that that her whole focus was on Christ, the sufferer. I mean, everywhere they looked, everything that was going on around them was suffering. And that Christ, who is central in her life, was the tortured human being. Christ, or Jesus, is the worker and the lover, the revolutionary who taught us how to work and to love. We have to, that was her entry into faith, was through Jesus Christ. But then she says that over the process of years, she also kind of lost sight of her relationship to God as the whole, as the creator. It became impossible for her, she said, to trust in God who was Father, Ruler, and Sustainer. And so she spent most of her life in a Christological direction as opposed to God being greater than that. But she said no longer...
I didn't understand. Well, she spent most of her life in a what?
The Christological pursuit. Study of Jesus Christ.
Oh.
And, who is the Christ? And as opposed to the Holy Spirit on one hand or the Creator on the other. So it's sort of like we tend to do that, I think, with our theology, is we tend to separate God into three parts. We do that in our creed. We recognize God as three persons, but all one. And our focus often is on one or the other. There are many who concentrate simply on the Spirit. And there are those of us who do concentrate more on the Christ. And then there are those who focus on God as Father or Creator. Okay. But she said now she no longer has God imprisoned in that, what she said, images of ruler, king, and father, that God is greater than that. And as she's come to experience God beyond Father, Son, and Spirit, then she began to be able to reconcile her faith with her new understanding of God as creator. Okay. She said, we all need a new understanding of creation. We also need, she said, to a sense of the past in order to understand the future. She said, and then her final quote in the first chapter, this is all from her first chapter, and it was just my attempt, I hope, to kind of lay the groundwork for why, for the next part. To believe in creation is to share the earth. And then in the second chapter, she talks about creation and liberation. And this is where we begin to sense her theology of creation, which is different than the creationism that we hear a great deal about. And She says you cannot experience creation without first understanding and experience liberation. The biblical faith in creation originated from an historical event, and that was the Exodus. In other words, creation was not written until after the Exodus. And it was the people coming out of the Exodus who had a sense of their relationship to God the Creator. They could experience creation in this new freedom that they had. And she bases that on a study that was done, or a paper that was done by Gerhard von Rad in 1936. Von Rad, who is a biblical historian, argues that Israel's enduring faith of Yahweh's enduring faith was the result of his redemptive deeds. Faith in creation was a comparatively late development, and it was a secondary belief. It wasn't something that was primary in the belief or the faith life of the Israelites. Israel's concept of God grew out of the historical deed of God's deliverance of the people out of Egypt. Genesis is an interpretation of the Exodus. Now that's new for me. That was new for me. I mean, to hear it said that way was enlightening. It was I wanted to know more. I always thought that the Bible was written first, you know, just from Genesis. I mean, each book came one right after the other. Well, I learned at seminary, obviously, that that isn't true. And I learned that in college. But still, I thought that Genesis was probably written before Exodus. But it wasn't. And that actually, and hearing it as an interpretation of the Exodus is rather exciting. Is that understandable? I mean, does that make? Am I making sense?
I don't
Jill?
Quite understand that. How is it interpreted? How does that?
Okay.
Are you going to go on? And
yeah.
Explain how
yeah. Yeah. Hopefully.
Yeah.
If I don't do it in the next page, let me know. Okay, the development of this tradition comes out of let's just take the Sabbath, the day of the Sabbath. We understand the Sabbath to be the day that was set aside for rest. God worked 6 days, rested on the seventh. The Israelites understood that, and she uses a passage from Deuteronomy chapter 5. If I can find it. Okay. Verse 15. That the Sabbath, which is a central institution in the life of the Israelite, or the Jewish life, is related to Israel's liberation. You shall remember that you were a servant in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God brought you out thence with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day. The keeping of the Sabbath came as a result of the Exodus. When they were slaves in Egypt, there wasn't that same sense of connection to taking that day for themselves. And so they connected God taking the day, the day of rest, to their sense of freedom to also participate in that. It made sense to them, as it maybe had not connected to them before. It isn't that they didn't have the creation understanding before the Exodus. It's just simply that that wasn't something that they focused on. We also respond to God because of our liberation, not because of our creation. that it's harder to remember or to be in touch with. It's harder to be in touch with the goodness of creation, the love of God for creation, if we're oppressed, if we're in slavery, you know, if there's anything that ties us to another human being in that kind of way. It's hard to experience the creation as good if we're oppressed. And for most of us, I think that's really hard to grasp. I mean, how, you know, it's not hard for us to understand the goodness of creation. Look, especially at Holden Village. You know, it's a gorgeous, wonderful place to just experience awe of the power of God in being able to create and to produce life. But if we were living in the context of slavery, or as you experience, you know, in Tanzania, the variety of ways that people can be oppressed in ways that we don't understand.
I would think that people that live in very depressed areas in the inner cities, and that I think anytime anyone's on a real down,
mm-hmm.
God is not near.
That's right. There's that God is part of the oppression in some people's experiences.
But the downer relates to our past experience and our hopes and expectations, doesn't it? Which in a sense, I'm almost saying that somebody can be in slave, tied to another person,
mm-hmm,
slavery.
Mm-hmm.
But if this situation is better than they knew as they were growing up, or had some relation to their hopes and expectations, they could be in a better situation than they had ever hoped.
Let's say that.
And I don't know, but I'm speculating on this.
There are, I'm sure, people who in slavery, when it was a very positive situation, it was good, but we usually think of slavery as being a negative, that the person is not a person anymore. But I mean, there have been slave owners, there have been any of these things where it's been a positive thing, but I think what you're pointing out, that it's the negatives.
Mm-hmm.
Well, maybe, although you were using the term tied to another person, which is a pretty broad context,
thought. Yeah. Mm-hmm. A bonded, maybe. That you don't think, you think you can be bonded to another person and still experience freedom?
I don't think you have to feel freedom to feel that you're not in a bad situation.
Hmm.
I think you're saying that if you're in bondage, you're in a bad situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if everybody views it that way. And I can't speak for
firsthand. I guess I can't speak firsthand either, because I've never been bonded either in that sense. You know, in the
most
sense of which I'm talking about bonding.
Most of us are bonded
marriage.
In one way or another,
yeah.
Or several ways.
Yeah, the bond, let's say,
in
a subservient way, right. That bonding certainly is true of marriage. I mean, that is a bond. But that's a choice of two people, a mutual choice, to share a life together. But for, in some marriages, that bonding is only from down here to up here. And I dealt with a lot of abuse and a lot of battering and a lot of that kind of thing. And that you know, then the person who is not mutually bonded is hard for that person to see any goodness in being even a human being, because she, and it's usually she, but not always, is the one who keeps getting battered around, you know, and doesn't have a good sense of who she is or God. She can come to that if she is released from that battering situation. She can come to a point of learning to like herself and to feel free in herself in relationship to God, but only outside of that battering situation. She cannot find it in the battering situation at all. Most people who are married don't understand that either, because you're in relationships where you work together. But to be, yeah.
A
What do you mean outside of the situation? Totally away?
Totally away from the batter. Yeah. You've got to get away from that person. Experience yourself as a whole human being again, and that takes a lot of time. And the only way you can do that is to be away from the person who puts you down.
Yeah.
Okay. That's the theology in which most of us experience our relationship to God through Jesus Christ. What is helpful for me in this book, this study, is that we don't have to accept all of that any longer.
What's that?
All of that concept of there will all, as long as we're bonded, as long as we're in these bodies, as long as, you know, I mean, that's what she is essentially going to help us, or she has helped me to do, is to think bigger than that. To say that is, you know, to be limited to the concept of, as long as I'm human, I will not ever, you know, I can't, there will always be these kinds of situations. I mean, there's a part of me that says, yeah, that's probably true. And that my freedom, my salvation, not my freedom, my salvation comes through Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. But that freedom is something different. And if we're only thinking about what happens after we die, then we're all okay. If we're talking about salvation as something that happens for us, that freedom, that release from the bondage, that release from everything comes only after we die. She asked the question, is there life before death? Okay? And that's a good question. You know, is there life before? We know there's life after death. The question is, can there be life before death?
That's what I meant. Mm-hmm. We can have that freedom now. We have it now. When Christ is here, because, you know, sure, we feel oppressed. I'm not saying that there's not that there.
Mm-hmm.
And sure, there's lots of negatives to go against us,
mm-hmm.
especially ones in minorities and certainly Christians in Russia and all these other places.
And women mm-hmm. in a lot of places.
Then, right.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. But it's not just Christians. We can't limit that sense of whatever, just to Christians. I mean, there are all the other people are also God's people. Even as Christians, I think we are called to believe that all people were created by God and all people are good because God created them. And that God loves all people, whether they are Christian or not.
Mm-hmm. I get the distinction I see there is that, like you made reference to having a choice earlier, we mm-hmm. human beings have a choice and we can choose to, you know, identify with Christ in a life here on earth, and there is a second part to it where you can draw on his power and holiness and that bit. Whereas those who don't make that choice, yes, they are good, yes, because mm-hmm. they're made by God, and yes, they're loved by God, but there's a part two, I guess, that they can't draw upon or choosing not to draw upon.
Except in some cases, they do draw upon another kind of power.
Right.
For them, which is right. As meaningful.
Well, as Angel told me, you say all men are good, but then I think there you can say all men are evil is because the man or the human race has fallen, we all share in mm-hmm. in evil. So by the same token we're all partakers of evil.
Mm-hmm.
And that we can understand freedom in a subservient situation. I think this is what Christ is teaching about life everlasting. In Swahili it's so much nicer to put uzima wa milele, or the uzima that is fullness, wholeness, completeness, the whole concept of things that relate very much to right now and will be fulfilled and consummated at the end of the next life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So you have both at the same time in different degrees.
And And I don't think, I don't think Dorothy Zola would disagree with that, you know, that understanding of having both at the same time. But I tend to sometimes get a little defensive when we narrow our focus simply to those who are Christian in terms of getting anything from God or giving anything back to God. See? I I'm not sure that's what I was hearing, but that's what I thought I was hearing, and that's why I get defensive. I'm sort of off here. We're at another point, which I hope to get to, but we're getting there. So I said, this is new for me. I'm learning, and it's good. The focus of the creation, she says, we our freedom doesn't come from our creation, which I thought was interesting, that we are enabled to understand creation in light of our experience of freedom. So it wasn't that we were created. We are created to be free. We were created for that purpose, but we don't experience our freedom simply because we know we were created. We have to have had an experience of being liberated. And for some, and that's why she centers her whole focus on Judaism as opposed to other, even including Christianity. Because in Judaism, there's the relationship between those two concepts of creation and liberation, which has been somewhat negated or left out. The creation especially has been left out of a lot of, you know, our Christian theology. So we do share with our Jewish sisters and brothers that connection between liberation and creation. There's a danger in separating the two. In separating creation from liberation, she sees them as a need. They need to be together always. She talks about the creationist who implies that the creation is complete, and that's the thing that that she really expands on as she goes through the book, is that creation is not complete. It wasn't just something that was done in 7 days, but it is something that continually, or 6 days rather, is a continuous process, that we still need to be liberated, even now in the 20th century. We need to be liberated from that which is unjust and that which is oppressive, and that's a part of the ongoingness of creation, of change. Creation meaning change and things, you know, continuously moving. One of the things that I think is real helpful is to look at nature and the natural change, and having experienced that here more than probably back in Minnesota with avalanches. An avalanche changes a lot of things, and that's a natural kind of natural order. That's a natural part of creation. And when an avalanche chute opens, you know, comes down off the mountain, it opens up that space. And what happened here is that when there's a spot up here on Martin's Ridge that there were a couple of rather substantial, I thought, never having seen an avalanche, I suppose it wasn't really big, but it looked big. You know, and it knocked out trees, and it, you know, knocked out rocks, and what it opened up was a whole new river, creek, that runs behind the chalets. And it's the first time in my life I've been able to see how nature changes without any help from me. And it was kind of exciting, you know, we had water running, and it's made its own little bed now. It's an old road, I guess. But there's an ongoingness. The eruption of Mount St. Helens was another natural phenomenon. You know, we can't stop that. That's how the earth continually makes itself and replenishes itself and keeps going. And so creation didn't end. It just got started. And we're still in the process of it. Looking at Genesis 1 through 2, 4a, She says that Genesis was written, that particular creation myth or epic was written in response to the Babylonian religious beliefs of the time. And remembering that the people lived under Babylonian rule. They had experience of that. And what the Babylonian understanding of creation was, that all people, regardless of race, nationality, were expected to be subservient to the king. And how did the king get to be king? In the Babylonian myth, it was, in the beginning, there was this chaos. And the whole, and there were all these gods, and they were all fighting for power and control. And the stronger god was the one who won, and that god subdued all the other gods. Now the other gods became servants of the king, but the king's demands were so great of these other gods that they decided that they needed a servant. And so they created the human being. So it was this hierarchical order. The human being served the lesser gods who were forced to serve the stronger god. And it was the way that the gods found their liberation, the lesser gods found their liberation by making a hierarchical social system. And the humankind was at the bottom. And so there was this whole emphasis on the subjugation of the human being. And that's the way creation was understood at that time in history. In the priestly account, in the Genesis account, God is not identified with the world. There is no human hierarchy in the creation account. In Genesis 1 through 2, 4a, everything just was created in an order, but not in any hierarchical order. The Christians adopted the Hebrew account of creation. But what she said, the problem for us now is that we have emphasized so much the distinctiveness and the separateness of God from the world and from humanity from each other, that we now have God out here in us here. But there is emphasis, there is evidence rather in biblical, in especially Hebrew scriptures, of God participating in the world. But because of all of the things that were going on in early Christian history, we tended to ignore God's participation in the world and kept God separate from it in order to keep God, to remember God as God is. There are some elements in creation faith that are liberating and some that she says are oppressive. The liberating parts of the creation faith is that there is no domination over human beings by human beings. That is not prescribed at all in either of the creation myths, epics. And it also cannot be used to legitimatize state power, racism, or sexism, but as it has been. And I think what she was focusing on is that section of in Genesis 1, 2, 4a, there's that whole section about having dominion over, the human beings have dominion over the rest of the created order. And that has been misinterpreted or misused in a lot of ways by humans in terms of how we think that everything here is for us to use instead of to care for. And in Genesis 2, it has to do with the creation of male and female, and that the male was created first and that the female then was created to be his support, to make things go well for him. When it can really be understood to mean that she was created out of him, or as in order to make him complete, so that together, male and female, make humanity complete. One cannot be complete without the other. It would work both ways. But it's not a domination, not a dominant subject kind of thing. But that has been misinterpreted, I think, in a variety of ways throughout Christian history. But she said that the pitfall, the emphasis, that which is oppressive about creation theology is three parts. The total otherness of God and God's domination over men, women, animals, and the earth. The second is a godless matter-of-fact earth. And the third is human loneliness, which we assume has to be there. It's that whole thing about assuming that we will always be in some kind of bondage or always be in some kind of evil pursuit. Which goes on to talk about the otherness of God. If we're going to focus on the otherness of God, then God becomes invisible. God becomes distant. God is not immanent. God is always transcendent. And that God has no need of the creation. That the transcendent God is really a projection of a patriarchal worldview that allows for... Did I turn it up too high? Didn't turn it up high enough? Is everybody warm yet? I'm still cold. Okay. Well, those are the notes. But I wanted to share what she came up with. How many of you remember James Weldon Johnson's poem about creation? And she uses this. She says, the opposite vein of the transcendent God is the black poet and activist James Weldon Johnson, who envisioned God as a needy being who created the world out of loneliness. And God stepped out on space and he looked around and said, I'm lonely. I'll make me a world. God's loneliness and God's need for the other is the beginning of creation. The theological emphasis on God's freedom to create or not to create mirrors the desire of, and this is what she says, the male theologians, to transcend interdependency, to enter a realm of imaginary, absolute freedom beyond relatedness, beyond love, and beyond justice. But, in other words, Johnson's poem depicts God's work as God's wanting to be involved in that which he created. And Johnson goes on to say, as far as the eye of God could see, darkness covered everything, blacker than 100 midnights down in a cypress swamp. Then God smiled, and the light broke, and the darkness rolled up on one side, and the light stood shining on the other, and God said, that's good. Then God reached out and took the light in his hands, and God rolled the light around in his hands until he made the sun, and he set the sun ablazing in the heavens. God is physically involved in the creation as James Weldon Johnson envisioned it. God used a smile. God used hands and God used feet to do the work of creation. And the only thing that Johnson has of that original creation are the words, that's good. There's just this whole sense of mutuality, interdependence, and motherliness, as opposed to the theology of authoritative power, independence, and absolute freedom. The poem continues. God walked around and God looked around on all that he had made, and he looked at his sun, and he looked at his moon, and he looked at his little stars. He looked at his world with all its living things, and God said, I'm lonely still. And God sat down. Can you just, I never had that kind of relationship with God, where I had a sense of God just sort of sitting down and thinking and being. You know. And God sat down on the side of a hill where he could think. By a deep, wide river, he sat down. With his head in his hands, God thought and thought, till he thought, I'll make me a man. this whole sense of relatedness. You cannot separate God from relatedness. Dorothy Zola says that the concept of creation is rendered empty and meaningless if it is not out of love that God created the world. If it is not out of a desire to be in relationship that God created the world. Self-sufficiency, she says, is a concept of a lonely and unrelated person. To conceive of creation in the framework of unrelatedness is to deprive creation of its most central element, which is love. And love implies relatedness. You can't love by yourself. And therefore, God really wanted us, because God wanted to be in relationship. Now that's written by a man who is black, a man who has experienced or had experienced that sense of the need for a God who understood his place in the world. And so he wrote this poem, which is not typical, especially Lutheran theology. But I found it exciting to hear and to read it in the context of a theology. It always just was a nice poem before. But to experience the freedom to maybe explore a new kind of new way of looking at theology, especially in this way, was exciting for me. She said the other second consequence of God's otherness is related to our understanding of the earth, and that has to do with our sense of believing that we can do anything we want with it. That sort of that God isn't connected to what we do with the earth. And what she does with this is she uses the speech of Chief Seattle when he went to Washington in 1854 to transfer the ancestral Indian lands to the federal government. And he says, "How can we buy or sell the sky, the warmth of the land? The idea is strange to us. Every part of the earth is sacred to my people. Every shining pine needle, every sandy shore, every mist in the dark woods, every clearing and humming insect is holy in the memory and experience of my people." Just to stop there, we had a Vespers last fall led by one of the women in the community, and it was titled "Murder in the Backyard." And what it was she had been flicking flies. She doesn't kill flies or mosquitoes. In Minnesota, that's a real trick. But anyway, just watching the ants in their sort of predatory nature, and how one ant had killed another and was carrying this ant back, and how astonished she was by this. And the sacredness that the Native American people have for the earth comes through some of those experiences that we share here. The shining water that moves in the streams and rivers is not just water, but the blood of our ancestors. If we sell you land, you must remember that it is sacred, and you must teach your children that it is sacred, and that each ghostly reflection in the clear water of the lake tells of events and memories in the life of my people. The water's murmur is the voice of my father's father. The rivers are our brothers. The red man has always retreated before the advancing white man, as the mist of the mountain runs before the morning sun. But the ashes of our fathers are sacred. Their graves are holy ground. And so these hills, these trees, this portion of earth is consecrated to us. We know that the white man does not understand our ways. One portion of the land is the same to him as the next, for he is a stranger who comes in the night and takes from the land whatever he needs. The earth is not his brother, but his enemy. And when he has conquered it, he moves on. He leaves his father's graves behind, and he does not care. He kidnaps the earth from his children. He does not care. His father's graves and his children's birthright are forgotten. He treats his mother, the earth, and his brother, the sky,
as things to be bought, plundered, sold like sheep or bright beasts. His appetite will devour the earth and leave behind only a desert. The attitude of the Native American toward the earth is rooted in a profound, she says, in a profound sense of relatedness to the oneness with nature. God exists within the created world and is not absolute ruler and lord over it. To believe in a creation from the perspective of a religious religion tradition that retains close ties to nature would mean to affirm the sacredness of all life on earth, not just our own. And that is a problem for us, I think. That we don't have... Oh, it's raining. Good. But I do think this is true. Now, and I'll share this and maybe get some feedback. I do think we have almost, especially in the Western world, more so maybe in the Western world than the Eastern world, but kind of just assumed that we own property, that the things that we have, we worked for, are ours, and we can do with what we want. Is that a fair analysis? Yeah, I was wondering. It's not just, we don't just experience it here any longer, but we've taken it and shared it with others. Is that true? The things that I hear about life in other cultures, especially in African cultures and in the East, Eastern cultures, is that there was the sharing. There was the Native American understanding of the sacredness of land and earth, and it was being willing to share with everyone who came along. But that doesn't exist as much there anymore either, because they sort of want the kinds of things we have. And we are depleting our natural resources. And is that an abuse of the creation? And ought we maybe to start looking at how we perceive as ourselves as human beings? We have the same needs as all the rest of the creation. We need